This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where during the first hour I want to review the developments of the last 10 days or so in relation to the primary in Indiana tomorrow, which I am terribly concerned is going to be stolen from Donald Trump. I'll explain exactly why. I think there have been several precedents that showed signs of the kind we're seeing here and where it's going to be very bad if it happens. But that's my prediction. I want to begin now with the first slide about Donald's estate sweep from last Tuesday. It was absolutely sensational. This is one of the greatest political triumph in American history, actually of all time. If you turn to the second slide, I can review the delegates he won in Connecticut, 58% to 12 for Cruz. Kasich actually came in second. Delaware, 61% to 20 for Kasich, Cruz 16. Maryland, 54% to 23 for Kasich, Cruz 19. Pennsylvania, 57 for Trump, 19 for Kasich. In that case, Cruz came in second with 22. Rhode Island, Trump 64, Kasich 24, Cruz 10. So in four of the five states, Cruz actually finished third. It's very, very strange, therefore, that he continues to talk about himself and promote himself and take some bizarre actions that one would only think would be appropriate were he, at the very least, a front runner, if not actually the determined nominee of the party. You see, Hillary's victories over Bernie, 4 out of 5, 52 to 46 in Connecticut, 60 to 39 in Delaware, 63 to 33 in Maryland, 56 to 44 in Pennsylvania, but in Rhode Island, Bernie pulled it off 55 to 43. Just to give you an indication of the dimensions of this sweep, in Pennsylvania, for example, Donald Trump took all 80 of the 80 counties in Pennsylvania, and my impression is he may have taken every county in all the other states as well, which is truly astonishing. The next slide gives us an update on where the delegates stand. Trump with 953, meaning 1,237 to win. Cruz, 400 plus back. Marco Rubio, not actively campaigning. Kasich with 153. With the Democratic delegates, 1,662 for Hillary, including 520 superdelegates. Bernie, 1,365, including his 39. So, The Democratic Party with his superdelegate thing had it really loaded in favor of Hillary Clinton. There's no question about it. The Donald's problems have been different because the Republican Party has been working against him. In fact, I've observed here in Wisconsin on the day of the Wisconsin primary, 5 April, as I recall, that I'd never seen a candidate who was so pilloried. And when a caller who was a bit of a shill, I'm sorry to say, called in to say, no, he thought that Matt Romney had it worse, I pointed out that that Trump was being attacked by both sides, by his own party, as well as the Democrats. It wasn't even a contest, not even close. Well, here on the fourth slide is a projection of how Trump could get the 1,237. Notice, in Indiana tomorrow, there are 57 candidates up, If it's an honest election, then he'll get a big bump. He may even take all 57. And then we have Nebraska, West Virginia, Oregon, Washington, California, the biggie with 172 up for grabs, which ought to put him over. But if not, there are other states such as Montana, New Jersey with 51, New Mexico, and South Dakota, where New Jersey, I think, is going to go completely for Trump. So it looks to me extremely promising for the Donald, even if there's a bump in the road tomorrow, which I'm sorry to say I'm predicting to be the case. I'll be very, very glad to be proven wrong. The next slide reflects the fact that the Donald gave a foreign policy speech. This was only the second formal speech he's given during this campaign. The first being a, to my mind, rather disappointing performance at AIPAC, where it seemed to me he was entirely too obsequious to Israeli and Zionist interests, though I think they were not quite convinced by what he had to say, and that they are promoting Cruz, in my estimation, as the guy who's going to be best for Israel, not the Donald. But it was a wonderful speech. He articulated many dimensions of a foreign policy that would be non-interventionist, not involved in all these wars of aggression in the Middle East, one that would expect our allies, for whom we've been providing defense, to pay their fair share, reconsidering the role of NATO. All of this is completely appropriate. And as the next slide shows, even the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Coker from Tennessee, praised the speech. This is an extremely positive sign, because the Donald is being faulted for having no foreign policy experience. And that he presented an excellent speech on foreign policy goes a long way. He did, of course, assail Iran improperly, declaring that in his administration, Iran will not be allowed to acquire nuclear weapons. But since Iran is not even pursuing nuclear weapons, that's going to be the easiest plank in his platform to satisfy. Iran doesn't want nukes, isn't pursuing nukes. So for the Donald to say he won't allow them to acquire them gives him a rhetorical advantage on a promise that he most assuredly can keep, insofar as Iran is not now and has not, at least since 2007, when all 16 U.S. intel agencies concluded that Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons, a conclusion they reaffirmed in 2011, or even the Mossad concluded in 2012 that Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons just 3 weeks before Bibi Netanyahu went to the United Nations and asserted precisely the opposite. Another positive development came from Pat Buchanan, as we see in the next slide, where Buchanan is talking about Trump putting America first, meaning that he's going to take into consideration the interests of the United States rather than, just go all out for types of policies that we have seen rampant since Bush and Cheney of regime change and endless wars in the Middle East, where both he and Bernie Sanders are on exactly the same side here. Pat Buchanan actually is a very smart guy. It's surprising for someone who's often regarded as an ideologue. I find Pat Buchanan's analysis to be very accurate, very objective. He doesn't mince words. He gets right to the heart of the matter, and he's impressed me tremendously. So I think the fact that Pat Buchanan was endorsing, embracing, supporting, praising Trump's foreign policy speech was a very positive development as well. Now, he mentions in his comments that this phrase America First has a history, and it turns out, as the next slide shows, that's been used as a line of attack on Donald Trump, because there was, in the past, an America First movement prior to World War II, in which even Charles Lindbergh participated, the first man to fly across the Atlantic, and that it was an intervention, an isolationist movement at that point in time. It was trying to keep the United States out of wars, Now, here you have the ADL, which is the muscle, political muscle, for the AIPAC, American-Israeli Political Action Committee. They call it public affairs, but it's a PAC. It's a well-known, the most powerful lobby in Washington, D.C., coming out to attack Trump because of the use of the phrase America first. Well, this is a juvenile kind of argument, training on an equivocation. It's something I taught undergraduates to avoid during the 35 years I spent offering courses in logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning. I was therefore simply floored when Tom Hartman featured Lamar Waldron on his show last week during the last half hour, which is something that a propagandist likes because then there's no one to call in because the show's off the air to contest what you're saying, and admitted he had not heard the speech. So here he was talking and attacking Trump because he'd used the phrase America first, completely independent of what Trump meant by it, which was simply putting American interests first, and going on and on and on about this historic precursor using the same name but with a very different character, which was an isolationist movement, which, according to Lamar Waldron, had various anti-Semitic aspects to it. Frankly, it was to me extremely disappointing that Tom Hartman would feature a man of this caliber, where I've encountered Lamar Waldron before. In fact, he and Tom Hartman, who I suspect had a very minimal role in relation to the book, published something called Ultimate Sacrifice about the death of JFK, where they claimed that the mob had learned that Jack was going to invade Cuba, to which they refer as C-Day, to parallel D-Day, the invasion of Normandy, and that the mob took him out and then kept Bobby quiet by threatening to reveal that Jack was going to reinvade Cuba. And so Bobby could do nothing about it. This is about as stupid a theory as I've ever encountered. Number one, JFK had announced to the world after the abortive Bay of Pigs that we would not invade Cuba. It would have been a disgrace to the United States to have done so after the president of the United States had given his word. He most certainly was not undertaking some invasion of Cuba. C-Day was a complete fantasy. If they had anything to support it at all, it may have been some contingency plan, given that the Pentagon provides contingency plans for everything, but it wasn't serious. And Lamar Waldron to present it as though he was actually planning to do that was incredibly irresponsible. Number two, if Jack had been planning to invade Cuba, the mob was so keen on recovering its resorts and casinos that would have allowed that to happen. And then if they had an issue with Jack, they would have taken him out afterward. The idea of taking him out before a planned invasion of Cuba is about as preposterous a proposition as I've ever encountered. And if you want to go to Amazon.com, you can find my review of Ultimate Sacrifice there, entitled Ultimate Rubbish, because that's exactly what it was. And for Lamar Waldron to give us a book about JFK that's ultimate rubbish and then to come on the Tom Hartman show and abuse his position by trashing Trump because of a phrase America first when he, by his own admission, had not even heard the speech is a complete disgrace. I say to you, Lamar Waldron is not a trustworthy individual and you should never believe anything he says. Completely disgusting. Irresponsible, disgraceful. Tom Hartman abdicated his responsibility here, though he did put up some perfunctory issues debating with Lamar Waldron. It was nevertheless contemptible. Here's now the most interesting situation we confront tomorrow. Leading up to tomorrow, because Ted Cruz has been desperate after the Donalds. Brilliant. I mean, absolutely magnificent taking of five states by these historic margins, a clean sweep. He initially dallied with a collusion with John Kasich, where he asked Kasich, to divide their resources so Kasich wouldn't invest resources in Indiana, but in two other states, and Cruz would get his opportunity to go one-on-one. But he betrayed Kasich right off the bat by talking about Kasich as having pulled out of Indiana. When Kasich was questioned about it, he was completely buffaloed. He had no idea what this meant, him pulling out, because he's still a candidate there. He still wants people to vote for him. I think when you talk about Lying Ted, this was just one more illustration. Given the Kasich thing backfired and looked like an act of desperation, he tried yet another, even more desperate gambit by tapping Carly Fiorina to be his vice presidential running mate, which, frankly, when you contemplate the situation, given that it's not even mathematically possible that Ted Cruz could win the nomination, and where he endlessly talks about there are nobody going to secure the 1,237 votes before the convention, he's whistling in the dark. Donald has multiple ways of making the 1,237. Cruz has exactly none. Zero, zip, zilch, nada. So who does this guy think he is? He speaks with a great messianic fervor as though he were God's designated appointee to run for president and become the leader of the free world. It's complete rubbish, especially when you get down into the nitty-gritty and discover the guy's a philanderer, has had multiple mistresses at his Senate office, subscribed to the Ashley Madison Adultery Magazine, that his name is in the D.C. Madam's Little Black Book. When are evangelical Christians going to recognize that this man is a moral imbecile, that he has betrayed the principles for which he professes to stand, and that far from being an exemplar of moral virtue, he's a pathetic, disgraced adulterer who has no business pretending to be a pure soul on the campaign circuit. I'll return to further considerations here, but in my judgment, no evangelical Christian ought to be enthusiastic about voting for a Ted Cruz. Now, so he taps Flory Corina, and as you see in the next slide, Andy Borowitz, who's a wonderful satirist, just made mincemeat of this. Cruz hopes to tap into the immense popularity of Carly Fiorina. Listen to some of what Andy wrote. In choosing the former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina as his running mate, Senator Ted Cruz hopes to tap into the immense popularity of one of the most beloved public figures in America. Minutes after the news of Cruz's selection leaked, political insiders called the choice of the widely adored Fiorina game-changer for the Cruz campaign. It's no secret that Ted Cruz has some trouble with likability, the Republican strategist Harley Dorison said. What better way to fix that than by choosing Carly Fiorina, a person everyone is absolutely crazy about? Fiorina's reputation for winning the hearts of everyone she comes in contact with dates back to her days as the incredibly well-liked CEO of Hewlett-Packard and before that Lucid Technologies. Well, for a dose of realism and to appreciate the biting satire of Andy Borowitz, consider this political cartoon, which just appeared in the Wisconsin State Journal, slide number 11. Which was adopted from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. PoliticalMatch.com, you all know Match.com advertised on television all the time. They have the best rate for second dates, so it's considered to be excellent. So here, Political Match. And why did Cruz pick Carly? Well, he's looking at her resume, where she fired 30,000 workers, was canned as CEO, failed at a failed Senate campaign. And Carly looks at why she should be the running mate of Ted Cruz, shut down the U.S. government, universally despised, losing to Donald Trump. I mean, there's a little dose of reality. In other words, this was a simply absurd choice of Carly Fiorina, who's going to do Ted Cruz no good whatsoever, none, zilch, zero. Plus, John Kasich was a bit ticked off because, after all, he'd actually been in collusion with Ted about this division of resources. So he had a legitimate reason to be ticked off. But get this, too. It means he gave away maybe the only bargaining chip he had, who would be his running mate, which he could have used with, say, Marco Rubio or John Kasich to get additional delegates. They, after all, have some. Carly Fiorina has none. So where do we stand now on the eve of the Indiana primary? Slide number 12. Dates, polls, who will win? Numbers for Trump, Cruz, Clinton, Sanders. There are 57 Republican and 92 Democratic delegates available. The delegate process is pretty straightforward. Three delegates are awarded from each of the state's nine congressional districts, with the candidate who receives the most voting taking them all. The other 30 delegates will be awarded to the candidate who wins the most votes statewide. Now, ordinarily, I would tell you this is a shoe-in for Trump. He's going to take them all. But look at the next slide, number 13. This is a sign that something is wrong. Here we have a new Indiana poll puts Cruz up by 16 points over Trump. This is a manifest absurdity. Nobody cares about Ted Cruz. All the action is on Trump. Even today, there were lines, blocks long to get in to see Trump. Nobody cares about Cruz. Nobody's excited about him. For them to report Cruz at 45%, Trump 29% is a reversal of what actually appears to be the situation, to wit, Trump at 45 with Cruz at 29. And the reason I say this is a sign that they're planning to steal the election is I've seen this before. When we had here in Wisconsin the contest between Scott Walker and Mary Burke for governor, where the Democrats were very enthusiastic, the Republicans were not, where Michelle Obama had come to the state twice, Barack once, the big dog Bill Clinton, historic turnout which favors Democrats. There was a poll released less than a week before the election saying that Walker was up by 53-47. I knew that was wrong. It was ridiculous. It didn't fit the circumstances. The opposite would have made more sense. And indeed, when it all went down and it turned out that Walker won, I invited a brilliant statistician by the name of Richard Charnin to study the situation with me, where Charnin has published two books on the theft of election using voting machines. And Charnin discovered that this election, like four other previous elections in Wisconsin, had been stolen using electronic voting machines. Where one of the most obvious proofs was the following. Milwaukee County is a bastion of Democratic support. And as I have already remarked, we had an historic turnout, which traditionally favors Democrats overwhelmingly. And yet in Milwaukee County, the greater the number of votes that were cast, the greater the percentage that went to the Republican candidate, Scott Walker. Now, that's just ridiculous. And indeed, it turned out that Charnin has been able to prove that Scott Walker's recall election was rigged to make Scott Walker the only governor who has survived a recall election. There were hundreds of thousands of Wisconsin citizens down at the state capitol protesting when he cracked down on public unions. I mean, this man was about as despised as any political candidate in the history of Wisconsin. There was a Supreme Court contest between a guy named Prosser and a woman named Kloppenburg, highly qualified, where Prosser was put into office because of a stolen election. I've already mentioned the Mary Burke, Scott Walker contest. Well, when we had the primary here in Wisconsin, it happened again where there was a poll put out. I mean, look. Trump had been leading by at least 10 points here. And then right before the election, the Marquette School of Law, which had given us the phony poll results about Walker leading Burke by 53-47, reported that Trump was now trailing Cruz by 10 points. I mean, that's a manifest absurdity again. As a 20-point shift in like 10 days, they don't happen. And it was ridiculous. And I was convinced it was fraudulent. Indeed, I was that very day, which, as I recall, was the 5th of April. I was actually in the studio of the talk show host, Mitch Hank, at 9 a.m. to 9:30, explaining that the election was rigged and what was going to come of it, and that they were doing this to put Cruz ahead of Trump, to slow down Trump, that they were going to minimize Bernie's margin over Hillary, which they did to about 10 points, and to put a bim bat on the Supreme Court, someone whom Scott Walker had appointed to three different judicial appointments in three successive years, where if they don't have a close personal relationship, none of it makes any sense. She was highly unqualified and had been exposed for writing grotesque columns while an undergraduate at Marquette, assailing gays and lesbians and talking about AIDS as the politically correct disease to have because of the attention it would get. I mean, it was a disgrace. At that point in time, she had a 75% disapproval rating. So you think they're going to turn around and elect her to the Supreme Court, again going against Joanne Kloppenberg, highly qualified? They had to rig it to make sure it would come out right. Now, here's the way it actually is, if you look at slide number 14, that Trump actually has a 15 or 16 point lead. The latest poll just reported on television shortly before I came on the air reaffirms it. Here's Trump leading 49 to 34. I believe this is an accurate poll. But the fact that they put out this fantasy poll that has no basis. I mean, how can you have polls so wildly divergent? There's a 30-point spread between these two polls. It means one of them is completely fantastic. Other polls have shown Trump with a consistent, significant lead. So what they're doing is salting the mind by planting the idea that Cruz could have a win so that when they manipulate the polls, you say, oh, gee, I guess that poll that we thought was an outlier actually had it right. Well, they didn't have it right. They rigged the election. That's what's happening here. Look at slide number 15. This is what we had in Wisconsin right up to the time that Trump versus Cruz took place here. There are 8 districts in Wisconsin, and this poll had many, many more, like 8 times as many participants as the Marquette School of Law poll that had something like 947 participants to give the skewed result of Trump being 10 points behind Cruz. Here's the way it actually was. District 1, Trump 62 to Cruz 37. District 2, Trump 62, Cruz 37. District 3, Trump 63, Cruz 36. 4, 52 to 47. 5, 53 to 46. 6, 57 to 43. 7, 66 to 33. 8, 62 to 37. There was no way Trump was going to lose here. And to create a beard, a disguise, a camouflage, they claimed that right-wing talk show hosts here had ganged up against Trump and caused him to lose. Well, that's ridiculous. Trump supporters don't give a damn what anyone else says. They know the man, the quality, what he represents, and they're mad as hell and they aren't going to take it anymore. So that was just a fig leaf. It was ridiculous. It was absurd. I have tried to get Wisconsin figures, including the devil's advocates, Mitch Hank, and others, including the Capital Times and the Wisconsin State Journal, to pursue this. It's blatant. The evidence is overwhelming. And they just appear to be too politically correct to be willing to acknowledge that these elections have been stolen in Wisconsin, which, of course, is a guarantee. They're going to continue to be stolen, where the legislature has been passing absurd policies that they would never pass. Do they feel their own seats would ever be in jeopardy? They have the security of knowing the elections are rigged in Wisconsin. And here in slide number 16, we have further confirmation from the governor of Arizona reporting that there was vote fraud in Arizona too, that she was cheated. The people of Arizona were cheated. Trump delegates were cheated. People have got to understand, she was calling for a return to paper ballots, which is completely appropriate, getting rid of these electronic voting machines. Here's yet another story about the theft of elections, in this case in Chicago, in slide number 17, this wonderful discussion on Russia Today was talking about how the board that reviews elections was being presented with one proof after another of the rigging of the elections taking place, and they were all dismissing it on the grounds that, well, these people weren't the experts, therefore, when it was simple addition, as the host was pointing out, completely ridiculous. Now, what else can we expect? Look at slide number 18. Demonstrators storm California GOP convention to protest Trump. It turns out many of them were paid to do this. It's not the first time. And yet we had a commentator on a national network acknowledging that they were paid, but saying she didn't see anything wrong with it. How stupid is that? We're allowing our public discourse to be polluted by interveners who are paying, and this is not the first time. Look at slide number 19. It turns out that right here in Janesville, which is only about 20 miles south of where I reside as I speak to you now, we had a whole group of protesters for Trump when he gave his first speech here in Wisconsin who were being paid $15 an hour. This is completely ridiculous. Shuttle buses, parking, signs, hourly pay available, $15 an hour due to economic inequality. Meet at 3300 West Trip Road, Janesville, Wisconsin, 53548 for pre-protest instructions and to get your time card. Here's another, even more outrageous, in slide number 20. This is from Arizona, where they actually created a barrier on the highway. Trump protester speaks, I was paid $3,500 to protest Trump's rally. And when you get down into the nitty gritty, it turns out those who were paying him appear to have been from Hillary Clinton's campaign. He was told by the old women in their 60s that if he was asked what happened, he should start talking enthusiastically about Bernie Sanders. This is one more sign of the degree of corruption of Hillary Clinton. Completely disgusting. Very thematic with our next story, which comes from Robert Perry, number 21, one of our nation's best investigative journalists. Is Hillary Clinton honest? Where he's not talking about the number of true sentences she has in her speeches, where she has a relatively high truth frequency rating, but more profound forms of corruption. Allow me to offer some illustrations. Slide number 22. There's been a Benghazi breakthrough now, and it turns out the newly obtained emails lead directly to the White House, where they were very concerned that the Benghazi fiasco that led to the death of Ambassador Chris Stevenson not be regarded as a policy failure of the Obama administration, and where instructions were given to claim that it was precipitated by the ridiculous little trailer, Innocence of Muslims, that casts aspersions upon the Prophet Muhammad. That upset people who are Muslim, of course, but it had nothing to do with what happened in Benghazi. So here's Hillary participating in lies. She spent 11 hours before the Benghazi committee deflecting questions and giving one lie after another. The woman is profoundly corrupt. Here's someone else who thinks so, too. Slide number 23. Turns out that Seymour Hersh explains he's discovered that Hillary approved sending sarin gas from Libya to the Syrian rebels. This would be the gas that was used to create the brouhaha that was going to entitle Barack Obama to start lobbing cruise missiles into Syria. Hillary was involved in that, too. Fortunately, the Russians intervened with a 50-page dossier that demonstrated that Assad had nothing to do with it, that it was by the rebels, where Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia appears to have had a role. It's very interesting, by the way, that 2 days after 9/11, George W. Bush entertained Prince Bandar in the White House, and they sat together on the balcony and smoked cigars because of the great triumph they had helped to orchestrate, known as 9/11. Completely disgusting. Here's another, slide number 24. Why black people should reconsider their support for Hillary Clinton. This is a brilliant article that goes through one policy decision after another where Clinton's desire to reform, welfare as we know it, to introduce new crime laws and all that, have severely adverse effects upon black communities and black families in the United States, and has led to the highest incarceration rate of blacks in American history. That is compliments of Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. They need to get their facts straight and figure out who their real friends are, because Hillary Clinton and Bill are not friends of black Americans. We've had the most interesting twist of events in slide number 25, when John Boehner, who was questioned at Stanford University, described Ted Cruz as Lucifer in the flesh. They said, now don't hold back. Don't hold back, John. He went on to say that Cruz was the most difficult SOB. He spelled it out, SOB he'd ever had to work with. And there are, you know, hundreds of others in Washington who feel exactly the same. Here's yet another fascinating revelation in slide number 26. Ted's wife, Heidi, said that Ted is an immigrant. During a speech she gave, she talked about Ted being an immigrant, Ted being Hispanic, which means, of course, he's not a natural born citizen. So that, in fact, he's not qualified to be president of the United States. That came from the man's own wife, Heidi, and when she realized what a goof she had made, what a gaffe, she said she misspoke. How can the wife misspoke about the status of her own husband and whether or not he's an immigrant, which means he's not natural born, which means he's not qualified to run for president of the United States? And look at the next slide, number 27. In fact, this is the first mainstream newspaper to say that Cruz is ineligible. It is the Arizona Republic, a part of the USA Today network, came out Friday in their online edition saying that Calgary Ted Cruz is not eligible to run for president of the United States. Indeed, the analysis they provide even raises questions whether the junior senator is even qualified to hold a seat in the United States Senate. Very significant development. This is going to get around. Now, here, this may be a contributing factor to the next slide, the next story, which is that the support for Cruz among the delegates is significantly softening. I think many are realizing that Cruz is not really that strong a candidate and that Donald Trump is providing convincing wins, that the Donald is bringing in, blue-collar Democrats and independents by the millions. He has acquired the largest vote total of any candidate in American history, even surpassing Mitt Romney of 2012 by a considerable margin. And, of course, he's going to earn more. So delegates are now asking themselves whether, you know, it isn't maybe a better idea to start thinking about supporting Trump rather than going down with Titanic Ted Cruz. Here's slide number 29 is an excellent distillation of top 10 reasons to support Trump. We waited 53 years for this kind of honesty from Dave Hodges, who publishes The Common Sense Show. Dave Hodges is a very perceptive, very smart guy. He's been all over Jade Helm 15, and he's now reporting on Jade Helm 16. Where I've explained in the past that 15 appeared to be a pilot project, a beta test, as it were, to see how far they could go, closing the Walmarts, converting them into command and control centers. This man is nobody's fool. And look at some of the quotes he has from Donald Trump in slide number 30. Americans, politicians are bought and paid for by the special interests. The politicians need the money to get reelected. They're not going to do what's right for you because, of course, you know, they're bought and paid for. And he adds that Trump should be careful because it was this kind of honesty that got JFK taken out. The wall is going to be so big and effective that when I'm gone, they will name it after me. He adds, Trump is correct that when you let off the books workers into the country, they lower the wage structure for millions of American citizens. Number three. People are concerned about taking in Syrian refugees. However, we do not know where they come from and what their intentions are, and they are completely undocumented. My God, given how much Muslims have been held responsible for major catastrophes in this country, according to the official reports, Muslims were responsible for 9/11. Muslims were responsible for the Boston Marathon bombing. Muslims were responsible for San Bernardino. Muslims were responsible for Charlie Hebdo. Muslims were responsible for Paris. ISIS is supposed to be bad Muslims. Iran is supposed to be run by bad Muslims. And, of course, Muslim hordes are invading Europe and committing all kinds of atrocities, including an astronomical number of rapes. Now, most of those stories, apart from the last, I regard as being false or at least grossly exaggerated. Iran, as I've mentioned before, is a peace-loving country. And the idea of demonizing Iran is simply fantastic. But the fact is that Donald has a receptive audience when he suggests we need to hold off on the immigration of Muslims into this country until we figure out what's going on here. Here's another four. Obama has brought so much disrespect to the office of the president that when he lands on Air Force One, there's nobody of note to greet him. That's what we recently saw in Saudi Arabia and in Cuba. I will force foreign leaders to respect me, and if they don't respect me, they will fear me. Obama and his special interest friends are the reason why the world walks all over us. Number five, the new omnibus bill passed by Congress and supported by Obama funds Syrian refugees and undocumented immigrants for our southern border. As Dave Hodges adds, no money for Americans, only for foreign nationals illegally coming into our country. And think now about a story I'm going to report at the end where Jerry Brown is now going to let millions of illegal aliens participate in voting in California. Here are more. Number six, Americans are not angry people, but we are angry at a system that does not allow us to achieve anything. Since 1980, in real dollars, Americans are working 20% longer for 20% less. And where is that money going? It's going to the special interests who have never made more money at our expense. Hodges adds, since the advent of NAFTA, we've witnessed the greatest wealth transfer in the history of the world. And of course, NAFTA has been a principal target of both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. Number seven, Hillary wanted to go into Libya. Ask yourself, who has the oil? It is ISIS. We do not hit ISIS, and our government is allowing them to take what they want. Dark, shadowy banking forces are supporting ISIS. We don't hit the refineries because we don't want to cause environmental damage. So we let ISIS continue what they're doing. Well, the fact of the matter is, as I have been able to establish, ISIS was created by the Defense Intelligence Agency in 2012 to put more pressure on the Assad government and to create an opening for the expansion of Israel to become the greater Israel, to which it has already aspired, dominating the region from the Tigris, Euphrates to the Nile. We have photographs. We not only have the documents from the Defense Intelligence Agency obtained by Judicial Watch, we have photographs of ISIS members sporting U.S. Army tattoos. The files of an aide to Senator John McCain have been hacked and show the videotaping of the fake beheading videos on sound stages in Tel Aviv or in Hollywood. There's much more, including that Iraqi army forces shot down two UK cargo planes delivering supplies to ISIS. And a week later, Iraqi popular forces shot down an American helicopter doing the same. ISIS is our creation, and many drone pilots are leaving the military in droves because they aren't allowed to attack ISIS. Here's another, number eight. Obama will fly a 747 to Hawaii to play golf and then talk to us about global warming. Here, of course, he's alluding to the squandering of resources to fly a giant plane all the way across the country, all the way halfway across the Pacific to Hawaii in order for the president to play golf. What a hypocritical behavior. Number nine, I campaign for votes and win millions and crush my opponents in the process. Meanwhile, the establishment buys delegates in both parties. The political system in this country is corrupt. The elections are corrupt. And indeed, I've been documenting this with a theft in elections that we have discovered in Wisconsin, I suspect tomorrow in Indiana, and during a conversation I had with Jim Condit, who is running for John Boehner's old seat in Cincinnati. Both the Cruz election in Texas and Kasich in Ohio were manufactured by the use of electronic voting machines. Everyone in Texas was talking about Donald Trump, and they were both promoted in order to slow down the Trump train, not because they're loved or admired in their own states. Number 10, free trade agreements are killing the American people. They have cost us tens of millions of American jobs. When I am president, I will see that every American corporation that relocates overseas for cheap labor will pay a 35% tax to bring that product back into our country. Manufacturing will return, jobs will return, and prosperity will return. Criminal Hillary will continue this practice pursued by Obama with NAFTA and the TPP. Criminal Hillary does not care about you, and if she is elected, things will only get worse. I have no doubt about it. And it turns out there are all kinds of triggers in the TPP, one of the most stunning being this, that it creates a board of corporate attorneys that have the right to override the laws and statutes of any nation, of any of the 14 Pacific Rim nations that are encompassed thereby, including the Constitution of the United States, which means that once we have TPP, the United States will have lost its own sovereignty. Tragic, but that's what the TPP represents. Bear in mind, it is a monster that imposes corporations as running the world. And remember, as Mussolini observed, fascism can be defined as the merge of big business with big government. It can equally be well known as corporatism. Those who are promoting these trade agreements are the fascists. Those who are opposing them are the anti-fascists. The consequences should be obvious. Bernie and Donald are opposing these fascistic programs that put corporations in charge of the world. Slide number 32 is significant because it reflects that the GOP elites are becoming resigned to the idea that Donald is going to be their nominee, that it's going to be impossible for Cruz to stop him, that Donald's bringing millions of new voters into the Republican Party, and that what they're going to have to undergo is a kind of a reformulation, a reformatting of the Republican Party, but where they're liable to win a lot of very powerful victories politically with all the newcomers by the millions that Donald is bringing in. Look at the next, slide number 33. This was published by my colleague Kevin Barrett. Will Hillary lose to Donald Trump? Unless, of course, the fix is in. I think this is exactly right, that once the truth comes out about Hillary, and there's a whole lot for the country to learn, and the Donald is not going to be hesitant about dishing the dirt, where we get some samples, for example, from Roger Stone in his book, The Clintons' War on Women, which explains how Bill was a serial abuser of women's and Hillary was a facilitator. Bill Clinton, many don't understand, was kicked out of Oxford because he raped a fellow student. And Hillary went after women who tried to protest their abuse at the hands of her husband, hammers and tongs. That's going to come out. It's already there in the book, but it's going to be translated into easily digestible bites in the form of campaign commercials, I have no doubt. Slide number 34, again, reflects that here we had a prominent political commentator on the Morning Joe telling Joe Scarborough that he believes Donald Trump could beat Hillary and win the general election. I'm going to say this out loud. I actually think this guy is going to win. Deutsch told a surprise Joe Scarborough on Friday's podcast. Obviously, the woman problem, the Hispanic problem, the demographics are very against him. Having said that, though, Trump voters on the right are so sticky. They're not going everywhere, anywhere. Everyone is voting for Hillary. They say half-heartedly, well, I guess Hillary, he said of Trump and Clinton supporters. Number two, he could go to the left and right of Hillary. He can pretty much put a portfolio of issues together that he's behind. Hillary is a hawk. Hillary is a neocon. She's never met a war she didn't like. She was responsible for the invasion of Libya and the destruction of that near-idyllic society. She told a group at Dartmouth last year that if she became president, she would bomb Iran into oblivion. She is a absolutely bloodthirsty individual, deceptive in her manner, that the American people are going to learn more and more about. Here in slide number 35, we get a further reflection about the Bernie nation can't get behind Hillary. And I think there are good reasons for it. Actually, Bernie has much more in common with Donald Trump in terms of policy issues than he has with Hillary Clinton. Look at the next now, slide number 36, the very idea of some kind of alliance between the Donald and Sanders was being poo-pooed on the opinion pages of the New York Times. But the attack that was taken by Charles M. Blow here really had more to do with socioeconomic status than anything else, suggesting that the Bernie supporters are better educated, upper middle class by and large. The Donald supporters, mostly blue collar, less well educated. But that doesn't mean they don't share a tremendous number of common issues. Look at slide number 37, for example. A Trump-Sanders independent ticket would win, many have observed. I've actually recommended it. I believe it's a brilliant idea. I think it would be absolutely unbeatable, very, very powerful. And why? What are some of the reasons for thinking so? Well, consider the next. These are commonalities between them. They both hate NAFTA, the TPP, and the PNTR with China. They both believe free trade causes American job losses. Their rhetoric and positions on trade are mirror images. Trump said about Sanders, "We both agree that we're getting ripped off by China, by Japan, by Mexico, by everyone we do business with." On NAFTA, Trump called it a disaster. Sanders said it has displaced a large number of jobs in the United States and is a significant contributor to the current crisis in U.S. manufacturing. Countless media outlets lumped their trade policies together already with headlines like Trump and Sanders common cause. So this is a natural pairing. Foreign policy. They're both non-interventionists who think the war in Iraq was a mistake. Trump has said the war was one of the worst decisions in the history of the country. Sanders has said on the most important issue of our time, I was right. Hillary Clinton was wrong. While Trump has a tougher appearance than Sanders on policy, if you go region by region, they are more similar than any two other candidates who ran in 2016. Taxing the wealthy. Everyone knows Sanders has said the wealthiest and large corporation will pay when I'm president. But Trump's rhetoric is nearly the same. He said he wants to raise taxes on rich people like me, and the hedge fund people make a lot of money and they pay very little tax. While Trump's latest plan doesn't back up these statements, his plan is clearly geared toward winning the GOP primary, not his core beliefs. And I believe another example is what he had to say at AIPAC, where it seems to me his actual core beliefs involve him working on the toughest deal he'd ever have to make between the Israelis and the Palestinians. I do not believe he is going to be a lapdog of Israel, as has been true of so many of his predecessors, and where Cynthia McKinney, of course, revealed recently that when new members of Congress arrive in Washington, they're asked to sign a pledge to put the interests of Israel ahead of those of the United States. If they do not do that, they can expect to find themselves confronted with a well-financed opponent in the next election, or perhaps even be redistricted out of office. Something will happen. It takes great courage to stand up against it. I believe Donald Trump is precisely the guy who would never kowtow to any form of intimidation of that kind. Here's another, government paying for college. We all know about Sanders' free college plan, but Trump has also said, well, the only way you can do it, make college affordable, is you have to start some governmental program, and you have governmental programs right now. So Trump is talking about expanding them, developing them, funding them more amply, protecting entitlement programs. Trump said, you know, Paul Ryan wants to knock out Social Security, knock it down, way down. He wants to knock Medicare way down. I'm not going to cut it, and I'm not going to raise ages. Sanders has said the chain CPI that Congressman Ryan supports is nothing less than a massive cut in benefits for Social Security. Everyone in Washington knows that it's easy to fund Social Security by simply raising the cap on the level of income that is taxed to support the program. It's effortless. It's obvious. And I am personally convinced that when Trump reviews the bidding on how to provide a suitable health program for the American people, that he will discover on a cost efficiency basis that the Sanders proposal to expand Medicare is the right way to go. So I expect that the Donald is, in fact, ultimately going to adopt Bernie's proposal for single-payer Medicare for All as his health care program. And Medicare, of course, was originally designed to be expanded to every member of our society, where the bureaucracy for its provision is already in place. We know very well that governments can provide programs like this with like a 2% overhead. And then if it's privatized, it jumps to 12% because of the profit margin government isn't seeking to acquire. I would also add here another issue on which they are 100% in agreement is the Second Amendment. Both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are strong supporters of the Second Amendment. Hillary Clinton, like Barack Obama, is seeking to deprive us of our rights to own weapons under the Second Amendment. Hillary has been appealing to the Sandy Hook parents for support there for emotional drive, which is completely inappropriate because Hillary has to know, like the rest of the world is gradually learning, that Sandy Hook was an elaborate hoax. It was a two-day FEMA drill where I published about it and even included the FEMA manual for a rehearsal on the 13th, going live on the 14th, and the book Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, 2015, which is 425 pages with 250 photographs, 13 contributors, including a half a dozen PhD, current or retired college professors who blow the story out of the water because the school was closed by 2008. In 2012, look at the photographs. It's not compliant with Americans for Disability state or federal requirements. That's because it was a non-functioning school long since abandoned. Two final stories. Here on number 39, as I anticipated, Jerry Brown, also known as Governor Moonbeam, has signed a new voter law that allows illegal aliens to vote in California. This appears to me to be an effort to put a couple of million anti-Trump voters on the California roster because illegal aliens in California are allowed to have driver's licenses, and now they're being automatically registered to vote. I mean, what an absurdity is this? The Secretary of State said that citizens should have the right to vote, but the point is they are not citizens of California. They are illegal aliens, thanks to Jerry Brown. Obvious. And finally, the last, at the convention, if it gets there, we can expect electronic voting to play a role again because they're planning to use it to manipulate the outcome to suit the interests of the Republican Party. Donald has to win it outright. I'm predicting they're going to steal the election tomorrow in Indiana. But look what happened after Wisconsin. He came back with a triumph in New York and then followed up with a most impressive political victory in five states in the East that I think we have ever seen in modern political history. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. Stand by for a very special program featuring an unusual set of issues. We'll be right back.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center. Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where for the second hour, I'm very pleased to have as my special featured guest, Pete Hendrickson, who's been going through an unbelievable experience dealing with the federal government over what appeared to be some slightly obscure issues regarding taxation, but actually turns out to be issues of enormous constitutional significance, where it may be that if the government is right and prevails in his case, that the government can force you to testify to anything the government wants, regardless of the truth of the matter. Pete, welcome to The Real Deal.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's great to be here. I'm looking forward to this hour. I think we're gonna cover some good ground. I wanna say, first of all, having caught a good part of your last hour, I love your position on the current presidential campaigns and your view of how things are going and how they're going to go. I echo and agree with most everything you had to say there. But I also want to pose an alternative view of that entire subject. And raise the question of how much better it would be if the presidency and the federal government in general were restored to its original constitutional design, such that the office and who held the office and what that person, the character of that individual and so forth, was not nearly as important anymore as it has become recently in our time of a unitary executive and a largely unrestrained federal government that does pretty much anything that it wants to, gathers vast resources out of the pockets of the American people, uses them to buy influence, to work its will, to compel people to behave in ways that are pleasing to other people who are politically connected, all the bad things that we've observed going on in this country today. And the fact of the matter is the founders didn't intend things to be like this. The founders intended for us to have a small, relatively insignificant federal government as far as the lives of the American people were concerned. And for the first 140 years of our history, it was, in fact, very small. In fact, for that first 140 years, all forms of government in this country, federal, state, and local combined, absorbed less than 10% of the economic output, the gross national product of this country. They were extremely insignificant. In fact, it was observed around the turn of the last century by political writer that the average American could go through his entire life having no contact with any federal official in any fashion whatsoever except the guy that delivered his mail.
Well, you know, Pete, what's penetrating about what you're saying is you're talking about the difference between the rule of law and the rule of men. We have lost the rule of law. We've been completely compromised. Barack Obama, for example, has been resorting to executive orders to introduce new laws and legislation, which are overwhelmingly unconstitutional.
Yes.
And between the time that he signs the executive order and the time it comes up for any kind of judicial review, all kinds of mischief can have taken place. He's violating his oath of office to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. It looks to me, given Chelsea's recent boast, that her mother now believes she can get gun control laws through because Justice Scalia is dead, that it may be that his mysterious death was engineered to precisely bring about that effect because he was an absolutist when it came to the Second Amendment. I put nothing past the Clintons. There's a string of deaths associated with their political careers that has yet to come to an end.
Yes, absolutely true. I don't put anything past them either. But I will say this: one of the things about the executive behavior that you just referred to very accurately is that the American people have been conditioned into simply accepting the notion that an executive order constitutes, you know, the equivalent of law. And it doesn't. And under the law, under our constitutional structure, executive orders have very limited effect. They affect the executive department. That's all they affect. That's why they're called executive orders. That's the nature of the beast. The executive has no legislative authority. But if people are willing to behave as though they do, if people are willing to take these things and treat them as law, then they are, for all intents and purposes, law. This is one of the reasons I used the theme in my first book, Cracking the Code, Fascinating Truth About Taxation in America. I used the theme of Alice in Wonderland because that was where Carroll was going. He was bringing out the point that the paradigm that we operate with as human beings is our reality to a very great degree. It controls what the reality that we operate in. And it's a matter of belief to a large degree.
You made two very astute points there. One, of course, the latter. In politics, perception is reality. Absolutely. And number two, that actually executive orders have very limited scope. But, you know, in the wake of Sandy Hook, already on 16 January 2013, Obama signed no less than 23 executive orders to restrict our access to weapons under the Second Amendment. And by and large, the public has presumed falsely, as you brilliantly observed, that those meant something for the whole country when actually they do not. So I think you made a very, very important, even profound observation about executive order.
Yeah, well, and the point that I want to get to here is that the a huge amount of the power that is exercised in Washington comes from its command of resources that it collects from all over the country, collects out of Americans' pockets. Their fire burns hot and big because they take the fuel out of your fireplace and my fireplace, and they get away with doing it because of a misunderstanding, because of that perception that you just referred to, that by the perception being all, people believe falsely, and I'm going to prove to you that it's falsely in a moment, they believe that the income tax constitutes a tax on all that comes in, that it applies to economic activity generally, when in fact it does not. And not only does it not, as a matter of law, but when people learn how it does operate, it's a scam. It's a scam that takes advantage of people's misunderstanding and people's lack of knowledge of the details of the law. When people do understand it, however, they don't pay it when they don't owe it. And tens of thousands of people that have learned that truth now do not pay that tax. And billions of dollars have been recovered by those tens of thousands over the course of the last 13 years from making use of actual accurate information about what the tax falls on and how it works and how they had previously had the money snookered away from them.
Are these parties able to recover past income tax paid improperly because it wasn't legally owed, or only from the time at which they recognize it moving forward?
No, past as well. There's a limit to how far back you can go, but it's several years, and it represents an awful lot of wealth. Anyway, I'd like to start drilling down on this subject a little bit with a video that I sent you a URL, something I uploaded this afternoon for the purposes of this program. And it is actually an excerpt from a slightly larger film, so it's going to cut in rather abruptly, but it is going to what we're going to watch is a few minutes of the testimonials by a number of folks who have indeed learned the truth about the income tax and made use of that knowledge, and then I want to show some exhibits of the manner in which these folks made use of this knowledge, and we'll go a little further into the subject.
Champs, go ahead and run the video.
My name is Brady Ness. I've always wondered about the income tax, and I've always been frustrated that 30% of whatever I work hard for can be taken from me. I never thought that was right or American. So I really started doing some digging, came across this book last fall, Cracking the Code, The Fascinating Truth About Taxation in America by Peter Hendrickson. The information in that book is worth its weight in gold. Not just money. I'm not just talking about money, but freedom. I'm an American. I want to be free. I did all of our taxes this year. This is our first victory from this year. This is a check from the Department of Treasury. You see the amount there, $36,000 was our first victory check, and I'm still waiting on several more to come back this year, and look forward to standing up for the rule of law in the future.
Hello, my name is Glenn. I live in a small Georgia town and work for myself as a SAS programmer analyst. In 2008, I learned the truth about the U.S. government's federal income tax by reading Cracking the Code and all of the material at LostHorizons.com. Since January of 2009, I have taken action to amend past filings, submit educated returns, respond to requests to complete forms related to the federal income tax, and to deal with IRS attempts to delay the return of my property. Tens of thousands of dollars have been returned to me, and I choose to no longer engage in activities connected to the exercise of federal privilege.
Okay, I'd like to talk to you for a couple of minutes about cracking the code and the website LostHorizons.com by Pete Hendrickson. I applied for my 2014 taxes, got them back 6 weeks after I put in for them.
Hi, I'm Barry Sullivan. Reading the tax code and the tax laws is incredibly frustrating unless you've been given some guidance beforehand. And the only popularly available source of that information is this little book called Cracking the Code by Peter Hendrickson. I can tell you from personal experience that I've for the last several years, I've been getting returned to me all my federal withholdings, including federal income tax, Social Security, and Medicare.
Hi, my name is Guy Placencio. In 2013, I read Cracking the Code, and that resulted in me getting all my federal taxes returned to me, which amounted to $15,400. The government returned not only my income taxes, but also my Social Security and FICA taxes.
Hi there, my name is Shandor Bors. I'm from Pittsburgh, New York, and in 2006, I read this book written by Pete Hendrickson from cover to cover. I had to read it 3 times to fully understand it. But since that time, I have filed knowledgeably. And the state of New York has responded by returning all of my withholdings that I've requested. Unfortunately, the IRS is slow on its feet. But I am patient, because I know, in the end, the rule of law always wins. And this little statement here will have the power and significance that it once had.
Joe Black, Delivery Tree TV. I'm going to talk about Cracking the Code by Peter Hendrickson. After you read this, you're going to know more than 90% of every agent that works in the IRS. So go to LostHorizons.com, pick up those books, and I swear you will be thanking me.
Hi, I'm Matt Zelina. I learned the fascinating truth about the income tax at LostHorizons.com in January 2005. Then I filed a tax return knowledgeably for the first time in my life. I haven't gotten my money back yet, but as soon as that accurate return went in the mail, I got back my dignity as a confident, self-governing, free American. Thanks, Pete.
Hi, my name is Brian Harris. I'm a licensed structural engineer here in Alaska with a master's degree from one of the top-ranked engineering schools in the country. By reading this book, I learned a key distinction between private sector earnings and federal income. And for the first time in my life, a couple of years ago, I was able to tell the truth on my tax returns. And this is the refund that the IRS has indicated that I am due.
Hi, everybody. My name is Eric Siegelstrom. Back in 2004, my wife and I discovered the fascinating truth about the income tax at LostHorizons.com. After discovering this new information, we, for the first time in our lives, filed an accurate, knowledgeable return in 2005, and the government's response was a complete refund of everything paid in quarterly installments, including Social Security tax, self-employment tax, etc. All subsequent years, our money has remained where it belongs, in our possession.
Hello, my name is Paul Eberle, and I'd like to talk to you about the income tax. I finally came across this book, Cracking the Code by Pete Hendrickson. Visited his website for a good year and read a lot of material. I have now filed 4 years of income tax educated CTC, and I am happy to report that I had a federal victory for last year's filing.
Hello, my name is Rod Schmidt. I learned the fascinating truth about the income tax at LostHorizons.com. Then I filed a tax return knowledgeably for the first time in my life and received all my money back that had been withheld from me, including Social Security taxes.
Hi, my name is Val Smithson. After several readings of Pete Hendrickson's amazing book, Cracking the Code, in 2004, I filed a proper refund claim return for the year 2002. For the first time in my life, I lawfully rebutted an erroneous information statement and knowingly attested to the accuracy and truthfulness of my return. Shortly thereafter, I received a complete refund of all the federal withholdings taken from my pay for the year 2002. And for each year since then, each proper CTC-educated return that I have filed has renewed my dignity as an American citizen.
Hey guys, my name is Jeremy Lee. I live in Atlanta, Georgia. Last year, a friend of mine recommended that I read Pete's book, Cracking the Code. Using the truth I learned about the law, I filed my tax returns correctly for the first time ever in July 2015, and I have already seen the IRS admit that I owe no tax for the past 4 years. Also, I have received back 2 years' worth of full refunds of Georgia state income taxes, and I'm expecting more.
This is an amazing book. I read it for the first time in 2011. I was amazed at what I was reading. I reread it probably a couple of more times. In the interim, I received a notice from IRS indicating that I owed money. Well, I applied the information that I learned in Cracking the Code, sent in the required documents, and subsequently I received their notice back that there was zero tax due.
I'm Forrest Anderson. I read this book, Cracking the Code, The Fascinating Truth About the Income Tax, in January of 2005. I discovered that while many people are lawfully required to pay federal and state income taxes, I was not one of them. My first educated income tax return was filed in April 2005. 7 weeks later, I received this refund check for $4,560. Since then, I have received refund checks from the Colorado Department of Revenue for the last 3 years. This is my 2006 check for $748. This includes $98 in interest for late payment. This is my 2007 check for $677. This includes $27 in interest for late payment. This is my 2008 check for $675. Payment was made promptly, so no interest was included. In March 2009, I received this CP-2000 from the IRS in an attempt to extort $8,168 in additional tax, penalties, and interest for my 2007 filing. I replied with a letter and document supporting the entries on my 2007 return. The IRS then sent me this letter 4314C informing me of a 60-day timeout while they reviewed my documents. The IRS then threw in the towel by sending me this nice, polite closing notice.
I came to CTC in 2004 by meeting someone who was already a CTC warrior from another state that I was living in at the time. And I'm very grateful to him for helping me understand and turning me on to the book. I'm in my third reading. It has changed my life. I think the main impetus for me was because I have a son. And like a lot of other people who are in CTC, it's one thing for me to deal with a system that doesn't work, to put it mildly. It's another to bequeath that to the next generation because we were too lazy or too afraid to stand up for what's right. And I realized that I couldn't bequeath that to my son. This is a legal path. This is a just path. And this is the only path that we can take if we want to retake ownership again of our country. And that's my goal. Every day I wake to that goal, and every day I go to bed to that goal.
On the bulletin board at LostHorizons.com, you can find links to well over 1,000 posted examples of the hundreds of thousands of complete refunds, closing notices, lien and levy releases, and more, secured by tens of thousands of readers of Cracking the Code over the years since the book went to print in 2003. Many of these examples of Americans keeping their governments within the strict limits of their lawful authority include the complete package of paperwork which produced the virtuous outcome. These victories, which have been continuously accumulating for well over a decade, involve dozens of state and municipal governments and tax agencies, as well as the United States and the IRS. By the way, the refunds secured by Cracking the Code readers are thoroughly vetted by the issuing agencies. The IRS description of its procedures in this regard will be found toward the end of the bulletin board page. On the Every Which Way But Loose page at Lost Horizons, you can find dozens of episodes of tax agency efforts to balk at educated claims.
Many years ago, a friend of mine told me that the primary function of the federal government is to collect information, disorganize it, and redistribute it. Simply stated, they lie to us.
What I would recommend is basically to read the book.
Get a copy of this book.
You owe it to yourself.
And you're going to want to read and use this.
Read it. Now you will not regret picking up a copy of this bad boy right here.
Read this book.
Read Pete's book.
Read the book.
Read the book.
I keep all the money that I earn. Read the book.
Well, Pete, it sounds to me like Cracking the Code has really cracked the code, that you've actually accomplished something, and a lot of people are pursuing your advice, and they're getting refunds, and they're calling the bluff of the federal government, which is dependent upon having the false belief that you owe a whole lot of money on which you don't actually owe taxes.
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell, Jim. The fact is the system succeeded in cultivating a misunderstanding of the nature of the tax that actually began shortly after the 16th Amendment was adopted. 16th Amendment in no way created the income tax. The tax predates that by more than 50 years. 1862 is actually the origin date of today's income tax. But that fact raises important questions in the mind of anyone who understands the thing. It is as buried as it can be and as suppressed as it can be, memory hold, so to speak. But shortly after the 16th Amendment was adopted, which basically restored the application of the tax to dividends and rent, which had been shielded from the tax under the Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust decision in 1895, only those two varieties of what qualifies as income, and that's income with quote marks, because income in the context of the tax only means federally privileged gains. Doesn't mean all that comes in. It means all that is federally privileged that comes in. Those two varieties were shielded under the Pollack decision, which ruled that that in application to those two things alone, the income tax constituted a property tax and therefore had to be apportioned. The 16th Amendment eliminates that singular ruling and only the things that it had affected, and restores those two items to subject to the tax as they always had been previously. But from that point forward, in part because the people who gain who enjoy the benefits of that those particular kinds of gains, dividends and rent of federally privileged variety, tend to be they're the coupon clipping class. They're the robber barons, basically. That's who it was. And they recognized that there was a substantial advantage when that tax was restored upon them. They recognized a substantial advantage in spreading the burden as much as possible. And so a campaign was begun to misinform people about the nature of the tax and what it fell on. And it took 30 years. It took until the mid-1940s before the opportunity was recognized by the government to capitalize on this 30 years of conditioning that had gone on. And many other things were going on during that same period of time as well. Government schooling was taking over the schooling of children. There was a generation at that point that had been raised, for the first American generation, that had been raised with government schooling as a predominant factor. The Depression had caused a huge change in the perceptions of the American people and their attitude towards government. They had gone from being very distrustful and jealously regarding their liberties and viewing the government in much the same fashion as the founders had viewed it, which was as a threat, a necessary evil, an evil. Necessary perhaps, but an evil, something to be guarded against. The Depression had caused a change in that attitude in a large percentage of the population. Not everybody, but a large percentage. And then we had the tumult of World War II going on. We had a very sophisticated propaganda campaign conducted by, of all people, the Disney Corporation, among others, who at the behest of, and in fact the demand of the government, produced a series of cartoons designed to encourage people to buy into some of these myths concerning the tax. All these things combined together, and an opportunity was recognized in the early 1940s to promote the idea, and it was done in the most absurd sort of ways. Actually, a new withholding structure. The withholding structure was renewed. It had been in the tax from 1862 up till 1916, and then had been allowed to die off or to go dormant at that point. But it was revived in the current tax payment plan Act of 1943. And as part of that, the Act includes a lot of words of art that are built in, giving special meaning to terms like employee, wage, employer, trade or business. Employment, all these things have custom definitions built into the law, which are obscure. And we're talking about a body of law that even at that time was 1.5 million words in size. It was impossible for anyone to really competently or effectively
parse. But it was also technical, too.
It was very technical. And so these terms with all these specialized meanings appear on forms. And all that was done was these forms were then sent to every business in the country. And these forms have things on them that say, for instance, report to us all of the wages paid to all your employees. Well, wages is a defined term. It doesn't apply it doesn't mean the pay that everyone gets. An employee is a defined term itself. It doesn't mean anyone who works for anybody. It only means a specialized component or subclass of the overall class of workforce. But
so all this trades on equivocation. All this trades on ambiguity of language.
And the definition.
Superficial popular interpretations versus their actual technical meaning.
That's right. And the
government allows it to persist because it's beneficial to the government that everyone should be acting on their misunderstanding of the tax code.
Exactly right. And the definitions were not included with these forms. So people started sending in the information. And every time this happened, it created a legal presumption, an actionable legal presumption, of the taxable status of payments that were involved. And people who also received copies of these forms began imagining that they were under an obligation to treat all of the earnings that they made as taxable income. And they began doing it. And they began, and that part of the doing it is signing a form under penalty of perjury, declaring the truth of what it is that they've been snookered into saying inaccurately. And so we went, here's the astonishing statistic. Prior to 1943, on average, fewer than 10% of the American public American households had ever filed a tax return. Fewer than 10% on average for all the years of the existence of the tax from 1862 forward. By 1945, it was 93% of American households that were filing tax returns. Less than 10% to 93% in 2 years' time.
Was it somehow affected by the engagement in World War II when people thought it was patriotic and they're helping to support the war effort?
Of course. And you know, I referred to the Disney cartoons and so forth. Taxes to beat the Axis. I mean, that was like one of the themes that Donald Duck actually, you know, drilled into people's heads in movie theaters across the country. It was just a complete perfect storm of disinformation, ignorance.
What would the government have done to finance all these efforts without taxation?
Well, it wouldn't be that they would be without taxation. The government is equipped to raise any amount of money that the American people care for it to have by conventional mechanisms. Direct taxes are the standard mechanism. Traditionally, they have been used throughout our history to finance large-scale government expenditures. Typically, they were done after the fact. The government would borrow money for a while in order to finance the War of 1812 and what have you. And then after the fact would impose a direct tax and collect
These would be taxes on goods and services?
A direct tax can technically apply to anything. It could apply to all economic
activity. But the point is it wasn't a tax on income.
It wasn't a tax. Well, there are several distinctions that are important about a direct tax under the Constitution, federal direct tax. They don't ever touch individual American citizens. They don't. The states are the ones who are liable for direct taxes. The states collect the taxes under the auspices or the limitations of their own constitutional structures, whatever they may be. And the total tax...
Some of this revolved, Pete, around the ambiguity between a federal income tax and a federal income tax.
That's a very, very excellent way of putting it, Jim, because the name does say it all. It's the federal income tax is a federal income tax.
A tax on federal income. Which is narrowly defined, far more narrowly than it's ordinarily supposed by the taxpayer.
That's exactly correct. And we've just seen a video that shows a bunch of examples of people who learned the distinction, learned what was being done to cause them to improperly pay the tax and learn how to fix it and ensure that it doesn't happen to them again. And they showed the demonstrations. They showed the checks. This is the way it is. And this includes Social Security, Medicare, and the nominal federal income tax, as those folks showed everyone and discussed. Now, I want to go to...
Let me just get this straight. So would Social Security, for example, constitute a form of federal income because it's provided by the federal government?
That's exactly correct.
So if I, as a retired person, have a substantial chunk coming in through Social Security, that would be taxable.
Absolutely. And there's a line for it specifically on your 1040. It absolutely is. It, you know, as awkward as it may be in some circumstances to say so.
If I were still a university professor, my income paid for my profession would not be covered because it wouldn't be federal income.
That's correct.
Wow.
Absolutely correct.
Wow.
Yeah. And the same thing is true of your pension, if you get one from the university or you know, whatever. The legal status of earnings remains the same, whether they be deferred or received. So.
Wow. I'm beginning to get the idea. For someone like me who's retired and who has a substantial income from Social Security and other from investments, you know, from a portfolio, it might be that most of my income actually is taxable.
It could well be. At the same time, you know, a good portion of it isn't going to be. And, you know, it's worth knowing. And in any event,
I agree.
It's not just the money. In fact,
I got sorted out. Yeah.
It isn't the money really at all. The thing about a tax structure is power. It is power. It is, even if you're not, have no benefit from the disciplines of the Constitution being upheld and enforced properly,
it's beneficial as a participant in a constitutional system to reinforce its application across the board to everyone alike.
Precisely. You want your neighbor to be keeping the money in his pocket if that's where it belongs, because money is power. And the power, when the power stays with your neighbor, it meets the founders' constitutional intention of diffusion of power. They recognize the importance of diffusing power, not allowing it to concentrate anywhere. We've seen the downside of allowing power to concentrate, because that's what we've been
living. Believe it or not, time is flying by. I don't know if you want to turn this up. This is fascinating and profoundly important. I mean, but to the average person, this is of huge significance.
Yes, it absolutely is. So let's cut real quickly through the PowerPoints, and then I want to get to a larger thing. So, okay. Are we on screen with the PowerPoints right now?
Yeah, put up the first one, Chance. Are we there?
Okay. What I put up in the way of the PowerPoints is to begin with, is three examples of educated filings made by people who understand the tax law and are acting to correctly rebut allegations made on one of those forms that I described earlier that were sent around to every business in the country, expecting to, you know, have them create actionable presumptions of taxable activity that would then be exploited if they were not rebutted subsequently. This is a filing. Joseph H. is filing. Joseph was actually one of the people we saw in the video. I think he was the third guy that held up that $14,000 check very proudly. This is the filing that he made in order to secure that. And real briefly, the viewers of the program will ultimately be able
to. It's got a whole lot of likes there, a whole lot of zeros.
A lot of zeros. You know, well, the fact is, Joe did not earn anything that qualified for the tax, and he knew it. So he knew to say so. And saying so is one of the key issues. If you don't say
it. Yes, you simply got to assert it.
That's right. If that form has gone out, that form has gone out saying you did, that W-2 or whatever, that alleges that that you were paid taxable activities. If you stand silent, it's taken as true. So you have to say no. And Joe knows to say no, and this is how he did it. Here's the page one of his form. As you see, as you say, zeros, wages, zeros. Let's move to the second slide, which will be.
Okay. Yeah, the back form.
That's the second part, the second half of his
form. Here he had $6,700 that have been withheld. Or a standard deduction exemption.
Yes, and you go down to his total.
This is the $14,000 where he gets it back.
That's right. $14,000 was the total of what he had withheld from him towards the tax during the course of that year, and he's asking for every penny of it back. Now, let's move to the third slide. This is the form in which he is reporting everything that was withheld, and you'll notice let's show where we get to the $14,000. We have the nominal. This basically models a W-2, except that it corrects the improper, incorrect information on the W-2. The W-2 incorrectly said that he had a big chunk of wages paid, and Joe knows that he did not. And so he is saying wages paid, zero. Amounts withheld, the amounts withheld match up exactly with what the W-2 reported. $8,500 in nominal federal income tax, another, $4,000 and some change in Social Security, and $1,100 or so in Medicare. Combine all those together, you've got the $14,000 plus that Joe claimed back. And let's move to the next slide and see what the federal government had to say about Joe's claim.
Wow.
$14,690.
Wow.
Every penny.
Nice check.
Every penny.
I like it.
The largest single refund that I have posted on my site, and the 1,200 or so examples of this sort that I have posted on my site, is $133,000.
Wow.
Let's move to the next slide. This is an example of an amended return where somebody had initially filed an ignorance return, that is to say what most people would consider a conventional filing, done without the understanding of the law, who then learned the law and decided to go back and recover what he had agreed to pay in his ignorance and what had been taken from him to begin with. And so he's filing a 1040X, reaching back in time a little ways. And
so what you're really doing is insisting that the government adhere to the law.
That's exactly right.
Allow citizens to innocently deprive themselves of money that properly belongs to them. That's just exactly. Because the government finds it in its interest to accept that money, even though it isn't lawfully entitled to it.
And it is happy to take it if people are foolish enough or, well, I don't like to use that word, actually. It isn't that anyone's being an idiot. They've been successfully sold a bill of goods.
Right.
And snookered into this. And
that's right.
It is shameful and outrageous that this has been going on for all of our lives, our entire lives and
yes.
more. This robbery has been taking place. It doesn't cross into outright fraud.
I've given the government hundreds of thousands of dollars to which it was not entitled.
You bet. Yeah, I'm afraid you have. And most everybody watching this show has done the same. So
I wouldn't mind having some of that back at this point in time.
Yeah, you bet.
I can certainly
go real quickly through this because I know we're getting short on time.
Yeah.
You can see, at the top, the original on the left-hand column here, the original numbers that were filed. The middle column is the corrections and the correct numbers, and the last column is the result of the calculations that come from that.
1040X.
And in this case, the total payments that this gentleman had made was $11,000. He had already gotten back a refund from his conventional filing of a couple of thousand of those dollars. The next slide is the backside of this thing. Actually not even important because there's nothing on it whatsoever except to show the date that it was done 2 years after the original filing. And then go to the next slide. There's his correction of his direct rebuttal of the original W-2 allegation. And you can see, just like in Joseph's case, zero for the wages, tax $10,000, and then another $900 in Medicare taken. That's where he gets to the
open. Slide nine is what he got back.
Next slide is what he got back. That's right. And it's important. Let's notice he gets the interest paid here as well, $445 in interest.
You get the interest from the government because they've held your money improperly.
That's right, improperly.
They owe you money for their having taken it from you and held it for the duration of time. Wow.
Exactly so. Now, let's move real quickly to the next one. This is a case in which the government attempted to resist an educated filer. Here's the return that Mr. Jackson filed. You can see it's a conventional educated return.
Yeah.
All zeros. Let's move to the next slide.
11th.
Okay. Here's his rebuttal of a 1099 that was produced by someone about him that had alleged that he had been paid a pretty fair chunk of money, some $55,000, $60,000. This is his instrument for saying, no, not true. I was not paid a federally relevant amount.
Right.
He puts the zero in and he puts his explanation and disclaimer at the bottom. Move to the next slide, please. Government disagreed. The government attempted to dispute him and alleged a $16,000 tax liability for that year. So it was arguing with him, with Tony. It said, no, we're disagreeing. We're proposing that you owe $16,000. Tony responds. Next two slides. The next slide and then the one after that. He responds, option three, I do not agree with this allegation, with this proposal. And then we go to the next slide, and he explains himself. And we're not going to read through this whole thing. We're going to rely on the viewers to just pause at this portion of the podcast.
I'm not refusing to pay taxes. I'm simply having taxes only directed against the part that I actually properly owe. Yeah,
that's right. And so let's move to the next slide, which was the denouement of the affair. This was
they conceded. They conceded.
They conceded. Inquiry is closed. Amount due zero. Sorry to have troubled you. They're not good with apologies.
Did he get a refund or just
He didn't have anything withheld. This was a situation.
He never gave them the money to begin with. That's what they were disputing, that he actually owed the money, which he insisted he didn't owe.
That's right. And they were forced to surrender.
And they eventually conceded he didn't owe it.
Absolutely. Now, Let's move to the next slide, and this is kind of what we're sort of leading up to here. As you know, the viewers have seen at this point, there is a huge issue here. There is a vast amount of importance to the American people, and there's a huge gravy train of pelf that the government and all of its cronies and all of its beneficiaries and all of its hangers-on and all of its camp followers have been luxuriating in for 75 years now, and they want to preserve that. And so during the entire 13 years since my first book was published, which is the one that you know you saw in the video, Cracking the Code, that has led to all of the things that we've just been looking at, during the entire time that's been going on, these refunds have been being issued by federal and 34 state governments across the country, week after week, year after year, 13 years nonstop, hundreds of thousands of these refunds and billions of dollars. But during the entire time that that's been going on, the federal government has been involved in a relentless campaign to suppress this information and keep the American people from knowing about it. And
Pete, even in the Marine Corps, you are not obligated to obey an unlawful order.
Well, okay, so the effort to suppress this in part has taken the form of attacks on me personally, and when that failed to cause any dent in the actions of the people who have learned this critically important knowledge, these people went after my wife. They, as part of this effort to attack the book, to suppress the book, the government had initially engaged in four legal actions attempting to get injunctions to suppress the publication of the book in the first place. They failed at all four of those, on all four of those occasions. Kind of unsurprisingly, they failed. They can't do it. The book is accurate. And, you know, we still have the vestiges of First Amendment rights in this country. The next step that they took was to file a lawsuit, completely bogus in every possible aspect, in which they claimed that the refunds that my wife and I had received for 2002 and 2003, the one being the first of those being the very first educator refund received by anyone in the country in American history, were mistakes. And this despite the fact that these refunds were incredibly studied and scrutinized before being issued. And the documentation is there, and I'm going to point people to the
copious, I'm sure.
So the method of this lawsuit, which they had no basis for whatsoever and recognized they had no basis for, was to ask a judge to order my wife and I to create a basis for them by ordering us to repudiate the educated filings that we had made for those 2 years and replace them with filings containing information dictated by the federal government itself.
They wanted you to comply with what was not the legal ruling, but the general popular impression of what was taxable income in order to preserve the illusion that the government was acting properly when, in fact, it was acting deceptively and in violation of the law.
Well, and even more so, they demanded that we be ordered to swear to our own belief in this.
How absurd.
Over our signatures.
Swear that you believe something which you know to be false.
Yes, which, of course, we didn't do. So in 2013, having failed to stem the tide of educated filings during all the years in intervening years, the government attacked my wife with an indictment for contempt of court for having refused to do this, to follow that order. In the course of two trials, this instruction was requested by the government and given by the court to the jury. And you can see what this says. It is not a defense to the crime of contempt, that the court order that the defendant is accused of violating was unlawful or unconstitutional. Now, on its face, you know, Jim, you're an educated man, and you know how to view these sorts of things. This instruction is patently false.
Yes.
Of course it is a defense.
It's an atrocity. It's not just false. It's an atrocity.
It's the most important, it's the most basic fundamental defense to a contempt charge, that the order is unlawful.
Unlawful, of course.
Don't communicate a duty. They lay no duty on anyone, and they can't.
This is like soldiers being issued an unlawful order to shoot innocent civilians. The fact that it's unlawful makes it not just permissible, but obligatory that you not follow it.
Precisely so. And in this case, this is actually not only an order that's unlawful on a First Amendment basis, but it commands perjury. To issuing the orders is a subordination of perjury. Everything about it is unlawful. It's simply, it is a crime that this happened. But this order, this instruction was actually given. What's worse, this instruction 4 weeks ago or 5 weeks ago was upheld by the Sixth Circuit Court, which ruled It ruled that it did not have to address the constitutionality of the orders involved. Didn't say that they were constitutional.
What a coward's way out.
It was
those judges don't deserve to be sitting on the bench.
It was horrendous. Anyway, we're getting we're getting towards the end of the hour now. This is the thing that's the most important right now. My wife right now is sitting in a federal prison camp 550 miles away from home. Has been there. She'll have been there a year, 2 weeks from today.
Because she's being held in contempt of court?
She's being held in contempt of court.
She's going to be there as long as she continues to be in contempt?
Well, she was sentenced to 18 months, but with the provision that within 60 days of being released after that 18 months, she has to commit the perjury that she has refused to commit.
Or she'll be sent back again?
Or she goes back again.
This is completely outrageous, Pete. I can't believe it. This is absolutely an atrocity. This should happen in the United States of America.
It is, but Jim, think about what it is. What's at stake what this is all about is trying to keep you and members of the audience that are watching right
this
now.
This is the essence of This is the essence of fascism and tyranny, right here, Pete.
It absolutely is, and it's in order to protect this.
And for the United States, up for fascism and tyranny is a complete disgrace.
It is absolutely.
It's un-American. It's unpatriotic. It's unconstitutional. It's completely corrupt.
It is absolutely corrupt. The solution is for people to learn this truth about the tax and start taking the power away from these people.
Is a case being referred to the Supreme Court?
We haven't gotten there yet because right now there's a petition for an en-banc rehearing that is currently in play in front of the Sixth Circuit. It only has a couple of weeks left to run in its course before it either is granted or
not. How good are your attorneys, Pete?
Well, frankly, I'm pretty good myself.
Is an outrage. This is a complete and total outrage.
Yes, and if there are any attorneys out there that are competent constitutional attorneys, I would love to hear from them because
Pete, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. We have to go to your last slide.
Yeah, let's go to there. It consists of a series of links, and there is a label on each one of them explaining what that link is to, and I'm hoping that the people who view this podcast will take the time to visit these links, learn these things.
Are you out of Cincinnati?
No, I'm in southeastern Michigan.
Okay.
So
this seems to me something that some principled politician would be interested in. A representative or a senator ought to just pick this up and crusade with it. Absolutely.
Well, I wish one would, and I'm there's contact information on the website, so anyone that goes to any of these links will find it.
You must give your wife my admiration and respect. Tell her I admire her beyond words. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your coming on the show today. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guest, Pete Hendrickson, for being here and all of you for watching.
Thanks, Jim. It's a great pleasure.
Great job, Pete. Great job.
Hi, this is Gary King. Here's a song written when I was just 18. People have always enjoyed this song, and finally, 40 years later, I went ahead and recorded it. If you like it, download it on iTunes. It's called I'm Not in Love, I'm Just in Heat. Gary King. Go to iTunes and download it if you like it.
About being without the one you love. But I'm with you, baby, can't you see? Not in love, I'm just in heat.
A song for 40 years played at party after party after party in the city of partying, New Orleans, Louisiana. If you dig it, go to iTunes and download it. I'm not in love, I'm just in heat, Gary King. And I also hope you enjoy the programming we provide here. And if you're into JFK, you can go to my YouTube channel, Gary King YouTube. And I do a weekly show with Jim Fetzer, Don Fox, and Larry Rivera. Hope to see you soon.